It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you, it's Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark, and Misha Mosley's here today.
Hey.
All the way from half Oakland and half New York.
Yep. Splitting the coast.
Yeah, so Misha called me yesterday and said she was in town for 24 hours, and we have not seen each other in 25 years.
Long time.
Yes, since high school. But the funny thing is, in those 25 years, we had very, very parallel lives. Mm-hmm. We both started stand-up at the same time, mm-hmm. and Misha's still doing it. You did a show last night.
Yep. I was at Comedy Sports on Belmont as part of the Catharsis Celebration of Social Justice and Comedy. It's a Sexual Violence Awareness Month in April. And they were like, how do we talk about a difficult subject and make it light, make it humorous? We want some comics who can deal with hard social justice issues and make people laugh and raise awareness. So they reached out and I said yes, and now I'm here.
So, well, yeah. No, I'm not here. They didn't say there was a podcast part of it.
No, that's true. That is true.
Now, do you have material prepared for that? Is it
well, my
chunk you usually do, or did you write some stuff for the show?
Both. Okay. All of my comedy is social justice comedy. It's, you know, I really got into comedy as just a form of self-expression. My jokes deal with issues, class, race, gender, sexuality, all of that stuff. And I think that's why I was on their radar. Yeah. Because it's another vehicle for me for teaching, but also entertaining.
Right, because you also have an education background.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I taught for several years, taught high school social studies, and then got burnt out, as many folks do, and ran away to grad school.
I got burnt out in 3 months.
It doesn't take long.
No, I did substitute teaching in Far Rockaway.
Oh, man.
And I went back to retail.
Wow.
I stayed an extra year in college. I did a fifth year in college so I could get my teacher's certificate. So I already had my English degree. Mm-hmm. And got my first job, and then I was still working in the comic book store that I was working in through college, and then when I started substitute teaching, the school was so bad that a teacher would call in sick every single day.
So you were just there.
I was there, but comic books always come out on Wednesdays, mm-hmm. so I always worked at the store on Wednesdays. So I just told them I'm not available Wednesdays, and my boss knew I'd always be there once a week. And then by about 3 months, I just went to my boss at the comic store. I was like, so can I work like Thursdays and Fridays again?
Yeah, it's no joke. It's no joke. Especially as a substitute. So I ended up substitute teaching in New York years later after teaching full time.
In Brooklyn?
In Brooklyn, all over, you know, while I was doing stand-up comedy. Because I initially didn't want to do any education work when I was focused on comedy.
Right. Which, as we learned, is a great way to go bankrupt.
Pretty much. Yes, exactly.
It's very hard to make a living doing open mics and bringer shows.
Turns out.
Yeah.
You can't pay your rent.
When you're performing to seven people who don't know who you are, mm-hmm. they don't pay you much.
Five of whom are comics, or the other comics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're making notes on their own sets.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Totally. So, but yeah, when you don't have the relationships with the kids, it's tough. Like you need to, right. You know, when you're there every day, when you get to know them and their families, you can stay in it, longer. Mm-hmm. It was tough. But, you know, I still wanted to be able to tackle the same issues I tackled in my classroom. I still wanted to be able to have a kind of exchange with people around big issues that were happening in the world. And then comedy gave me that opportunity. So I basically took it from the classroom to the stage. And, you know, people come to a comedy show, they want to laugh. They're not like, ooh, can you give me a history lesson?
Well, and that's a hard line to walk sometimes, mm-hmm. with, like, political comics, even successful political comics. They a lot of them get to a point where they're so successful, like say a Bill Maher,
mm-hmm.
where it becomes, or even Bill Hicks towards the end, it becomes more about the message they're telling, and they start to lose the jokes.
Right.
So it's got to be a hard line to walk. And I know there's a few political comics I know
mm-hmm.
that have been doing it for a long time, and I always wonder, is that a hard line to recognize?
I think so. I think when if you listen to a set, you listen for the laugh. So how long has it been? Have I been pontificating on the latest whatever for a minute and a half
right.
before the joke comes, let alone the punchline?
Right.
And I think for me, it's really taking real life. It's taking stories, it's taking anecdotes, and bringing out the funny so that people can think critically, but we're going to move on to the next thing,
mm-hmm.
you know? Because if I make you too, like, you feel like you have to bust out your notes, you know, and take notes on it, you know, we're losing the comedy, we're losing the fun.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's always the reason for being there. So it's got to be a difficult blend. How was the show last night?
The show was amazing last night. I mean, I'm excited by this organization, Catharsis Productions. I was really impressed. I mean, I'm like, they do all this social justice comedy. They, brought together a really great lineup, and the audience was primed. And for me, you know, I was in Chicago last year doing the Chicago Funny Women's Comedy Festival.
Right. Yeah. We almost met up then.
Yeah. Exactly.
We just missed each other.
So
that would have been 24
four
years.
And that's why it wasn't
meant to be. Which makes all the difference. It's that so 25th different. Year that you forget and chose names.
Exactly, Bill.
That's when the Alzheimer's sets in. Like 24 years. Oh, I know.
It's like,
I can tell you anything that happened in 1990.
Right.
89, I don't know, Batman.
Right, exactly. That's
but on, but honestly, if you pin me down for any year, 1976, Batman.
Right. I was going to say, that's going to be your stock answer no matter what.
It's been around since 1938. I'm not wrong.
Always. Always. Yeah, so, you know, the show was great. The audience was great. And what I loved, the show last year was fun as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a comedy festival, so people were just there to hear a bunch of comics. What was great about last night was it was focused on social justice. So, you know, if I'm telling a joke about gentrification, people know what I'm talking about. They get it. They're not looking at me like, what are you talking about me? Is that, you know, I was telling jokes about reparations, you know, and, you know, this being Obama's former city and, you know, talking about voting for him twice. And I didn't assume that everybody in the room agreed with each other, but mm-hmm. everyone in the room was informed enough to have an opinion, to be able to be open. You know what I mean? Like, I might have thought it was funny, even if I disagreed with what you were saying.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I remember that. I was a huge George Carlin fan. And I remember mm-hmm. he, in the 90s, he got darker and darker and darker. And he became atheist when I was still very Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time I thought, wow, I don't have to agree with you in order to think you're funny.
Right.
And because I thought that stuff was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so,
and it's you know, that's what you want from the comedy side. You always want to be funny.
Right.
I think for me, the social justice aspect of it is it's where you're punching. It's all about punching up. You know, it's all
And comedy's all about punching up.
Yeah. Well, not always. I mean, part of the reason why I stopped doing the, you know, a bunch of open mics or a bunch of club shows, just general club shows, is I'd get there and, you know, as a Black lesbian, I'm pretty much like target number one.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get
through. I
wonder
how many people were surprised by that in an audio podcast.
Oh, yeah. Hey.
It's like, we're at minute nine. She's a Black lesbian.
There you go. Quiet as it's kept. but, you know, you show up to a show, you want to tell some jokes, and I've got to come after. I remember doing a couple shows in Sacramento, and I was after, like, three guys who made all these rape jokes. Mm. I was the only woman on the bill. And it was one of those, like, you know, because comedy's heavy. It's a lot of men. And then it becomes...
Well, and there's that whole debate that women aren't funny.
Right.
Which I think it comes from just that there's so few women
mm-hmm.
that... And, you know, in comedy, most men aren't funny. I mean, it's...
Right.
It's a... Colin Quinn once said it's a meritocracy. Like, only the funniest people really rise to the top,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you figure that, you know, 80% of the men doing it aren't good. If 80% of the women that are doing good, now you've got a handful.
And it's also funny to whom, because one of the things I've found through this process is everybody's funny to somebody. And that's the piece. Like, my job was to find my audience. My job was to tell the jokes that I want to tell, make sure they're funny, mm-hmm. and find the audience for them, as opposed to trying to change what I want to do or kind of add some stuff on the side so that, you know, people will like it. So, for example, I don't curse in my real life, and like, I just never have. I never developed it, right? So much comedy on stage, it's like, it's kind of funny. You throw in, you know, some curse word and it bumps it up.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, and people ask me, can you play clean? And I'm like, it's easy for me because that's all I got. Now, if you want me to avoid difficult subjects, I'm not your comic. Right. Like, mm-hmm. It's going to get dicey if somebody just, you know, I'm not just going to tell fart jokes or something like that. So I had to find my audience. And that's what was so great about last night is I felt like, oh, these are the folks who, you know, who want to hear this type of stuff versus when I play more tourist areas and it's just anybody showing up.
Right. And that's the problem, you know, with clubs. I mean, the way clubs advertise themselves, mm-hmm. they're just come in and it's comedy.
That's it.
And if we're lucky, your headliner has a credit you've heard of.
Right.
You know, this guy was on Comedy Central. So yeah, so it's funny, just show up. And then mm-hmm. it's that weird feeling. The last show I seriously did in stand-up was in Philly. Mm. And they had a Philly's Funniest Competition. Everybody lied about their address so we could get on the show.
Nice.
And everyone I knew from New York did it. Everyone. So we would, so, you know, we drove up 100 miles. And I opened with, like, my smart, nerdy jokes.
Right.
Which they didn't get in Philly. Mm-hmm. And now that I've watched Always Sunny in Philadelphia, I see what they get in Philly.
Nice.
And they didn't get a joke about Francis Ford Coppola wine.
Right, right, right.
And how the second glass wasn't as good as the first glass.
Oh, that's nice.
And like that was my opener, nice. Which they nice. Loved in, like, Creek and the Cave and Rafifi's.
Oh, totally.
Yeah,
totally,
but
totally.
It just tanked. And then I have a 100-mile drive home alone.
Right.
In like, the car. And I'm like, you know, advertising was paying me.
Exactly. You start to rethink your life. But that's, you know, and that's the thing. It's when people go hard at this, because of the image of being that celebrity comedian, you get caught up in capitalism. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's art. We can't forget that it's art. And you can do a lot with your art. Some people can make money off of it. Some people use it as a political tool. Some people, it's, you know, it's a hobby. Like, there's so much you can do, but you can't forget the artistry in it.
Right.
Because when you're just trying to please the crowd, and you know, comedy's different, I think, even than music. I think about a lot of my musician friends. You can write a song, record it, and people are going to like it or they won't. You can write a joke, but if you're going to perform the joke, you need the audience in a different way.
Right.
To be able to actually get back on a stage again.
Oh, yeah. I used to say when I stopped doing comedy, I immediately joined bands again. I still do bands. And this is kind of the extent of my comedy now, mm-hmm. which is kind of the way I was comfortable was hosting. Mm-hmm. But the guys I was in bands with said, oh, you used to do stand up. And I was like, yeah. They said, what's that like? I'm like, well, it's like if we stopped the song after every verse and went, did you like that verse? Because now I got a chorus. You ready for the chorus? If you don't like the chorus, I won't play the chorus.
Right, right, right.
Because it's so about what you're getting back. And and that was something I didn't realize was, you know, when you start out, you get your 5 minutes.
Right.
And then you realize, you know, everybody's building towards their hour. Mm-hmm. But you have to have more than that hour if you're doing regular club shows because, oh, I have 20 minutes on my family and this is a bunch of drunk college kids.
Right.
You know, they're not going to like any of it. So now I have to have these single 20-year-old drunk stories that I have that work.
Right.
So you have to have like several kind of acts. Unless, as you said, you're able to hone down and find your audience.
Right. And I think, you know, part of it is it's a tricky road to that. So, you know, I'll do a lot of college shows, but it'll be for Women's History Month or, you know, the African American something celebration. So there's some department that's bringing me in to put a comedic spin on something,
right,
which is different than, you know, the student union saying, okay, this is our big homecoming or our big festival. We want comics. Let's go get Misha Mosley.
Yeah, which is never a good idea. They did that. I went to Brooklyn College. Mm-hmm. It was right in the city. And one day we were sitting at the bar in the student lounge, and there was a little stage there that and a mic that no one ever used. Then all of a sudden, somebody just walked up there and started telling jokes for like 10, 15 minutes. Just out of nowhere. Not, I don't think anyone agreed to let this person on. I don't think they decided there was a show.
Right.
I think this person found the stage and a mic and went, I'm doing it.
Nice.
And then we met him after the show, and it was Dave Chappelle.
What?
This is 1993.
What are you talking about? You're talking, but what are you talking about?
I'm talking about I saw Dave Chappelle three times.
Are you serious?
I am dead serious.
Dude.
And it was years before I thought about doing it. And I saw Dave Chappelle three times. I saw him once then at Brooklyn College. I saw him once in Washington Square Park in that big circle.
Oh, yeah.
Where he was yelling. Like, it was that time in the 90s where performance artists would go
there.
Yeah. And then I saw him at the Comedy Cellar in 2007. Where he showed up at 1 a.m. and bumped Artie Fuqua and talked for an hour and a half.
What?
Yep.
So it's so funny that you mentioned Washington Square Park because I remember being little. So we did forensics, you know.
Yeah, that's how we met. Yeah. So we one of the things we have in common, which also kind of shows things we did afterwards in high school. We did forensics, which nobody understands unless they've done it.
No, yeah.
My family thought that I was going to be practicing medicine.
Good time.
Yeah. Right? But it was it was speech and debate.
Yep.
And the debate people were very young Republican. They were very driven. They were very alpha male. I think a lot of them are salesmen now.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then there were the speech people, and Misha and I were drama people.
Yeah.
So we were doing characters, and I did – when I was doing drama, I was getting like first place. Mm-hmm. And then I switched to comedy, and I didn't place at all, and I wouldn't stop doing comedy.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, you were determined. You were quite determined.
Oh, I was totally – I'm determined right now. I'm sitting like, in my house trying to make you people laugh.
Like, I'm going to do it. This is how it's going to be.
Yeah.
Well, so after that, you know, I was that nerdy kid. Like, every birthday, my mother would extend my curfew. And I'd be like, but I never go out. She's like, you don't have to be home till 11. And I'm like, yeah, I'm watching Saturday Night Live. I'm going to be home by the time. Like, what are you talking about?
I'm not leaving.
I think that was her way of trying to get
I
me
out. I can't come
of
back if I don't leave.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, when we weren't in forensics season, because those were my Saturdays.
Yeah, it was every other Saturday.
Yeah. I remember going down to Washington Square Park in that circle within the fountain and saying, someday I'm gonna do stand-up comedy in this circle. And to this day, I haven't. I've traveled all over the country. I've headlined a bunch of different places, done big shows, small shows. And every time I pass by there, I'm like, you should do it. And it's different now. I think part of it is that it just feels like a touristy.
Yeah, it's not that era anymore. My memories of Washington Square Park was I would always cross it to get to Forbidden Planet Comics by Eaton Square, and then go to St. Mark's and buy Beatle records.
Nice.
So it was always like, this is the late 80s. It was still kind of seedy. It was kind of coming out of that, like Soho being that really creepy Velvet Underground, David Bowie, CBGB's kind of stuff.
I would always go to Discorama on 8th and go to all the stores, like all the shoe stores, and try to like...
Right.
You know, what are the cheapest Doc Martens I can find? Because I really wanted my mother to buy me Doc Martens.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was an era that was very, it just felt very authentic, I guess, and improv, and just sort of like gritty in that old New York.
It was very gritty, where it was like, you could see the people that came out of that scene. And there are not a lot of guys that came out of that scene that are huge, but like Louis Black came out of that scene of like the underground theater, playwrights and spoken word, like that Eric Bogosian kind of era. And a lot of those guys were so suited for that environment that when that environment, first of all, they couldn't quite break it through into mainstream. And then when that environment changed, they just looked weird. I mean, like the last guy I think that kind of transcended was like Eddie Pepitone. And Eddie Pepitone gets a lot of work as crazy old New York guys.
I was just about to say but that's his kind of shtick. Like that's what he does now. And it's you know, there'll be something else to replace it. You know, we're definitely of that age where the when I was a kid.
Yeah, we're old.
You know, but it's, you know, I feel like it's a special era, you know, like, and I think actually that's why, you know, there's more of a demand for this kind of social justice comedy, because we're like, listen, we want to, there's so much going on. We want to streamline some things. We have multiple interests and there's this, there's all these opportunities to express ourselves. Like, let's put them together. Like, I don't actually have to go protest in the streets and then do a comedy set as though I have not just protested in the streets.
Right.
I can actually talk about that because it's real, because it's happening. And chances are, you know about it because everybody knows everything.
Yeah, because everything. Yeah, and I've been wondering about that lately. I mean, as we're recording this, you know, the Baltimore riots are going on, and we've just had Ferguson, and I'm wondering, are things getting worse, or do we just know everything? So there's more. There are more people outraged because it was the kind of thing where, like, if was Ferguson happening 20 years ago, just nobody knew that.
Well, I think it wasn't happening in the same way. And I think part of what we're seeing now is our generation, like the promise of our generation is somewhat, we're in our prime right now. So if you were telling, you know, if you were telling little black kids, go to college, you can be anything you want to be, right? There's a bunch of 40-somethings who are doing well and a bunch that aren't. Right. A bunch that are still in jail because of some crazy charge 20 years ago, right? And so I think part of what's happening now is that we know everything, but it's sort of like the curtains, you know, the whiz has been discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are like, yeah, I'm not buying it. You got to bring me something else. You can't talk about these freedoms, these rights, these ways of being, because this is all one big experiment. We still haven't figured out how to all live together.
Right.
Like we still, I want to be this like diversity, inclusion, multicultural person, but there are some super, super right wing people who want to do all kinds of things with my body and who I am as a person in the world that I'm like, I'm kind of cool off of you. Like, you know, I want to be the person that's like, sure, I could be your neighbor, but.
Yeah, but there's a lot of weird people that you don't want to be.
I'm like, can you live in that town over there?
And you're right. It is an experiment because it's like, I feel like capitalism, we're living this age of unchecked capitalism.
Absolutely.
Since the 80s. And it's, and the same way communism was this huge experiment that Russia did and then found out, well, that doesn't work because everyone's not altruistic. People are going to try to get a little more. And then Russia fell into chaos.
Right.
So America seems to be heading in that same direction of like what you just said. If you work hard, you will get everything you want in life. And then people are hitting these glass ceilings, whether it's because of race or of religion or of networking or of class. I think I think it all falls under class.
And that's what I was just about to say is like this class, it's what are the wealthy doing to sort of play with this? Like communism wasn't going to work as long as there was an owning class that was going to make sure it didn't work, right?
Right.
And so even here, there's this gap. I think when we were teenagers, we could see the possibility. Now, I don't know if people see the possibility of whatever middle class could really look like balance-wise. So I learned something yesterday. I was doing some work in education, and we're talking about the housing redistricting in New York. And there's all this stuff around having affordable housing. That's the way, you know, because they're buying up all the projects. Basically, the government's, the housing authority is letting the projects go down. Developers come in, buy it up, and then they promise to do 20% affordable housing. This is the catch. In New York City, affordable housing is defined by the average median income, which is, I'm going to make sure I get it right, for a family of four, $135,000.
Wow.
Because you're counting everyone who's in the wealthiest part of the city.
So they're ruining the curve.
Right. And it's not, you know, and again, it's not the mean, and even if it were the mean, you know, this is where I'm like, okay, mean, median, whatever that third one was, you know, mode. All of mode, that was it.
Mode was the easy one because it was the number that appeared the most. When that was on the test, I was like, I know mode because look, I've seen 40 three times,
there it is. But, you know, so it's like if affordable housing is basically that you're still falling somewhere in the middle class, what happens to the working poor,
right?
Like, and even though we're raising the minimum wage, that's still
And there's a lot of resistance to raising the minimum wage.
Totally. Yeah. You know, and so that raises, and then everything else, where, well, we have to raise our prices in order to pay our employees. It's like, yeah, you could also just make a little less of a profit, right, and balance some things
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
There's an option too. So, yeah. I mean, I think that's where I think things are getting worse. I think the gap, that class divide where people no longer see the possibility of passing on something to their kids. Mm-hmm. And really actually creating wealth, it's like you can maybe figure out how to make it to 50 or 60. You've got to be firmly middle class to really feel like you have a solid retirement plan. Because otherwise you're just like, I'm just going to work till I die.
Yeah, I'm feeling 50, 60. And then I worry about working till I die, because then it's like, well, when I get to 60, 70, who wants to hire me?
Right.
Because I also work in an industry where you're expected to change companies every now and then.
Right.
And which is the way most of us are going. Most of us do not work. Most of us do not get out of college, get a job in the mailroom, work our way up to executive.
Exactly.
That doesn't happen anymore. Right. So it everything is kind of short term now.
And I think that has, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, we're in our prime. This I'm writing a play about Generation X. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in our prime earning years and the game is different. Yeah. We're not following our parents' blueprint. We actually want it all. We've done, in my opinion, a little bit more in terms of a balance than I would say is some of the millennial generation, in the sense that they're still coming into their adulthood.
Right.
So there's not the same perspective. Whereas, you know, I say, like, when I went to predominantly white institutions, colleges, right? So I said, I wasn't the first, but there are certainly were not a lot of me.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a different, it's that middle place to be. It's like, oh yeah, I'm doing better than my parents, but maybe not as well as they may have dreamed for me.
Right.
Right. And so this delicate balance of, if we're at the prime, if we're the folks who are like making stuff happen right now, what are we doing?
Right. You know, because I'm at the point where I'm doing better than my parents did, but I don't have more than they did.
Right.
Because everything changed so much, because, you know, my house was 8 times what their house was.
Mm-hmm.
And my car was 4 times what their car was. You
right.
know?
Right.
And it's, I remember I had an argument with my uncle about 10 years ago. I was in my late 20s. And I was renting, mm-hmm. I was renting an apartment on Queens Boulevard. And I just got a guitar. I just got like another guitar.
I was going to say, you got another guitar.
I got another guitar. Yeah.
This is not, you're like, I got a guitar. Like, ooh, here's my first guitar.
And my aunt came up to me and she's like, you're ruining my life. I'm like, why? Because every time you get a guitar, your uncle says, well, I need to get that guitar. Even Jonathan got that guitar. He's my nephew. And I turned to her and I was like, but you have a house.
Right.
And we do live in this era where it's like, we can all have iPhones, but right. We can't all own property. You know,
we can
get these things that didn't exist 20, 30 years ago, mm-hmm. but things we thought were basic.
Right.
You know, middle class isn't safe now. Like,
right.
I don't know that there will be a middle class when I'm 60, 70. Mm-hmm. So it's not even the fact of, you know, will I be able to retire, but like, will my way of life even exist? Like,
right.
will what I do be knocked down to working poor?
Right. I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, who's determining the value? And this is why I feel like...
And it's capitalism, which is the 1%. Is
right.
And that's the confusing message of these people that own companies are like, well, if you worked hard,
right.
you would be able to do this. But they're the ones giving out the jobs.
And this is this is where I feel like our mobilization of our communities, no matter where we are around consciousness raising and taking action, is super important, because when we stop buying the products, we were talking about this today, when we decide that a product is bad or a company's not good, they have to make adjustments.
Right.
And so how do we begin to use that power of numbers to actually start to get some of these shifts that we want?
Yeah. And in fact, the example we used was McDonald's. Mm-hmm. McDonald's, every time McDonald's has been attacked of having unhealthy food, they add another menu item.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to McDonald's, there are smoothies and there are grilled chicken wraps and there are salads.
Right.
But the problem they're having, which is why they now have to close 900 locations worldwide.
Yeah, that's a lot.
is that they haven't made their core menu items any better. Mm-hmm. Like a McDonald's cheeseburger is garbage, and it's the same kind of garbage it was. You know, right.
But we're saying no now. Like this is the thing. Like the and this is what you know. When you ask with Baltimore, are things getting worse? It's like the problem has been the problem since this whole we're going to take and not we, but like since the take over the United States, import some slaves. Don't let these people in from Europe. Okay, yeah, now we're going to let them in. That whole, like, 1500s to, like, today. You know,
to modern civilization. Right?
You know, has been the issue. And I think what we're seeing now is an opportunity for us to say, yeah, not okay. I'm not buying your burger.
Right.
Make an adjustment.
Right. And that, yeah, that's what the market will bear.
And so we have to decide how much we're willing to shift this market with all of these issues that are going on in the world. And I sit on these cusps this week between Baltimore and the Supreme Court marriage equality business. And, you know, all my black folks are like, even my black queer folks are like, we can't talk about marriage equality when all these things are happening. And it's like, that's true. Like, we need to talk about all of these things.
Right.
And for a lot of people, marriage equality is super important.
And there will always be more than one thing happening.
Right. And the thing is, but no one was checking for marriage equality until wealthy white Republican men decided that they wanted to come out and they wanted to start funding some things and they wanted to start making this an issue. And so then we started to see this whole shift and people talk about Baltimore and it's like Stonewall was a riot. There is no gay pride. There is no I'm your super ally. There's none of that without people taking to the streets. In that case, and in this case, against the police and being like, not okay, not on my watch. Right. So it's sort of like...
And all these things are known because I'm seeing how they're reflected in entertainment.
Yeah.
Because I always go back to entertainment and how that kind of shapes things. Is that when Baltimore happened, I wasn't surprised at all. And I like Baltimore a lot. I've been there a lot. I have a cousin who lives there. And it wasn't so much that I was there, it's just because recently I've been watching The Wire. And I'm like, this was 10 years ago.
Right.
And it was all based in fact. It wasn't this post-apocalyptic Mad Max type world. Right. I'm like, well, if this is what's going on, then of course this is going to happen.
Yep.
And as you were saying about the housing projects, they're actually using that in the Netflix Daredevil.
Oh, really?
Series. Yeah. Okay. Is that...
I got to get on this Daredevil.
It's
everybody.
Great.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's so great. Okay. But the main plot of the Kingpin, who, you know, is the main villain. So Spider-Man villain, who's the main villain in Daredevil. I know you're not that big at comics.
I'm learning.
I know. I've been trying since the 80s. But the Kingpin is basically Marvel's mafia guy.
Okay.
So he started out as Spider-Man villain. They started using him in Daredevil, and now he kind of belongs to both. But his scheme in the Daredevil series is to buy up all the housing projects in Hell's Kitchen.
Really?
And take them over and then run that neighborhood. And the thing I thought was brilliant was Daredevil was always traditionally Hell's Kitchen, which in the 70s and 80s, as we were talking about, was a horrible neighborhood.
It was called Hell's Kitchen for a reason.
Yes, it wasn't because it was hotter there.
Nice. But have you been there? Well,
yeah, well, I was mentioning this when we talked about Daredevil. I worked at Ogilvy 10 years ago in Hell's Kitchen. It was gorgeous then. Yeah. The Improv.
Yeah.
Which is now the Broadway Comedy Club is right in Hell's Kitchen. I worked there for a year. It was gorgeous. But the way they explained it was that the fight at the end of Avengers damaged the city so much that it turned it back into the 70s Hell's Kitchen because it just wiped out all the nice buildings.
No, okay. Okay.
But again, you see these things reflected, so which is surprising when people go, well, I can't believe this is happening. It's like, if you're fictionalizing it to a point where this has been production for 2 years and you're using that.
Right.
Obviously, it's in the public consciousness.
It's somewhere. And then as an artist, you have to ask yourself, what am I doing? What am I doing to actually bring these issues to life in a way that it's going to inspire people? Because the thing is, if you get on, I think, as a comedian, if you get on and you're preaching, like we were talking earlier, it's the funny that allows the release so that now I can think about it. Now maybe I was like, I had such a good time. Yeah, maybe I will be more inspired to do something.
Right.
Right. It's like music. If all the protest music from the, imagine if all the music that was all about the anti-war, civil rights, all that from the 60s and 70s, what if it all sucked? where would we be? I think we'd be, I mean, we wouldn't, I can't imagine you could go through the things that folks went through between civil rights, Vietnam, women's lib, all that stuff that was happening during that era that we covet so much.
So what if
without a dope soundtrack?
Yeah. So what if like all the folk music, like what if Bob Dylan was just doing bad poetry slams?
Is that right? What you're saying? Yeah. And if like James Brown was just like the whole time and never really talked about, like, I look at some of this.
Yeah. Or even Johnny Cash in country music.
Exactly. I mean, in all of the genres, it's like, you don't have to be somebody other than you. It's like, do you, but be excellent and do something with the gifts you have. Like, that's the key from whatever era you're in, whatever your thing is. And that's what I feel like this moment is. It's a lot of people saying stop because people take to the streets. And what I'm seeing in Baltimore, which I'm appreciating, is much more of a critical lens. Like, I'm seeing many more people say, hey, how come Arab Spring was revolutionary and Tiananmen Square was revolutionary and this is just thuggery?
Right. I love, have you seen the articles and memes about just about white people riding over sporting events?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and totally. And how that's just a crazy party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then this is something, you know, somehow responding to decades, actually centuries of oppression is somehow, you know, something else.
And I really love how I've been seeing a lot today as we're recording this of people showing peaceful demonstrations.
Yeah.
Showing like citizens of Baltimore blocking the police from harm or, you know.
Because there's a balance.
And showing a mother stopping her kid from rioting.
And she's, you know, she's doing that in part because I feel like nowadays there needs to be a balance. In part, I saw this.
Well, there always needs to be a balance. We've just been without one for so long.
And it's like we've been doing the peaceful protests, there was one meme that was about, people say if we just protest peacefully, they'll leave us alone. And it was all the lunch counter sit-ins. And then, you know, the from the 60s with the kids, you know, getting stuff dumped on them and being spat on and all of this. And it's like, I believe in peaceful protest. You need that. You need something where, and I've participated only in peaceful protests for the most part. Like, I'm not actually, at this point in my life, nor at any point, was I ever really interested in going to jail for right. what I, and I think part of that has to do with being a teacher. And it's not that I shouldn't have been more revolutionary, I couldn't have been more revolutionary, it's that the way I wanted to contribute was through that lane. And when I see people protesting peacefully, and then it turn, and the media, what's happening with the media, the difference now is that the media is on stuff more. And now I think with Baltimore, they're getting called out more.
Right.
Because there's like coverage on the media coverage.
Yeah.
That people are talking about. And so you can't assume that somebody getting arrested at a protest is some radical person who was trying to like disrupt and make things all crazy violent. Like now it's like, yeah, something could have just popped off. Something could have been provoked,
right.
You know.
Right. And that's something we were talking about before, is that there's a good side and a bad side to losing the mainstream media. Because we now live in an age where there really isn't a mainstream media. Mm-hmm. What there is thousands upon thousands of niche medias. And and obviously there's the dark side to that, which is people that only watch Fox News.
Right.
You know, and even though whether or not you're conservative or liberal, it doesn't matter. But Fox News is called out for misinformation all the time. But the people that only watch Fox News never hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then they go out using facts that aren't true. So that which is the dark side of being siloed. But then the other side of it is, as what you're saying is that the media is trying to portray the Baltimore riots as one thing, and then from the internet, which just a groundswell of like, wait, here's the other side of that story.
Here's footage of what's happening.
Yeah, and we could never have the other side of the story. We always trusted our news sources.
Now. I mean, Al, I have trouble. I have trouble, you know, thinking to myself, all right, I wake up, I'm not going to buy a paper. When we were little, it was like the New York Times was fancy. Like, I remember it was the Post, the Daily News, and the New York Times. And I remember when Newsday came back around and people were like, what's this? Oh, sports. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was proud that we had news, that we had Daily News, because that meant we weren't snooty enough for the New York Times, but we weren't low class enough for the Post.
It's perfect.
It was the middle class New York paper.
That was what it was. And now it's sort of, where do you go for quality information?
It's social media is where it is. Because you know what? You can go to CNN.com. You can go to the New York Times.com. You can go to FoxNews.com. But where people are getting their their news is on their Twitter feed.
Right.
Somebody linking to the NewYorkTimes.com.
Right.
I just read, this isn't political, but I just read a really great article on David Letterman.
Mm-hmm.
There was like almost an exit interview for David Letterman from the New York Times. I didn't go to the New York Times. You know,
interesting. You're right,
I had like four comedian friends post it, and I was like, all right, well, it's got enough recommendations. And I'm the type of person who I kind of wait for recommendations before I get into something.
Yeah.
I watch almost no shows in season one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm constantly binging season one while in season three.
Yeah.
Because I needed to have a pedigree. And now I can kind of do that with the news.
Yeah. But the challenge is we're charged with keeping up with stuff because you want to know what's happening in the world. But it's like by the time you filter through everything.
Right.
Because even on the other side, you know, the left of center stuff it can be just as bad.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like, really, y'all, come on. It's actually a much more complex argument.
My rule
than
of thumb is if it has an insult in the subhead.
Right.
Because if it's like, if the headline's like, Obama signs controversial statement into law, and then the subhead reads, what a buffoon. I'm like,
right,
this is going to be too skewed.
Yeah, that's a good indicator. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's.
Why conservative idiots? I'm like, nope.
Yeah. Now we're just yelling at each other and we're just fighting.
And we've learned that you can just do that. I mean,
right.
You know, that's what Fox News does.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Fox News was really hoping CNN would yell at them. Or that headline news or MSNBC. And MSNBC tries, but they're not as powerful and they get shut down. So they pick on Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert.
Right.
Because they're left and they're popular.
Right.
And Jon Stewart spent years going, this is a comedy show.
Exactly.
And then eventually he started engaging. And then after engaging for a while, he quit The Daily Show.
Right. Because it's like, this is not it. And that's, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, that's the thing with the art. If you lose sight of it as art,
mm-hmm.
if you can't have fun in it anymore.
Right. And I think that's where Jon Stewart got to, where Colbert was always having fun with it. Now he's going to be Letterman. He's not, we had Mike Brum on the show a few months ago, one of Colbert's writers who's going with him to late night. I doubt they'll do anything political. I think he's going to be the next Letterman.
Right.
You know?
And it's, you know, I've done that. Now I'm going to do this. And as long as he does it well.
Yeah, and he seems like somebody who's enjoying it.
And that's the piece. And still being able to use as a platform, because even in that role, it doesn't necessarily have to be, you can be political. You are political by the guests that you choose to have. How you use whatever platform you have tells us what you're about. It doesn't matter what your platform could literally be that soapbox in the middle of the square. It could be the fountain, you know.
It could be this podcast.
It could be this podcast, right? Like, you know, what are you doing with it? And because we can all decide what we want to listen to, is what you have to say, is it going to expand my thinking enough? Is it going to push my buttons enough? Is it going to, you know, take me to action out of my comfort zone? If I'm in a comfort zone, if I'm in a pain zone, is it going to offer some healing? Because that's the other thing with comedy. You got a lot of people who are in pain every day,
who
are dealing with like stuff that we couldn't imagine and are looking for an escape. And so if that escape can also offer promise and not just an escape.
Hope.
And possibility, that's powerful.
And a lot of comedians come from pain because it's, you know, humor is a defense mechanism.
Right.
And to be that funny, you have to be overcoming a lot.
Well, this is, you know, and we, you know, we lost one of the greats fairly recently in Robin Williams. And,
right.
You know, I loved him and what he and Whoopi Goldberg and Billy Crystal did with Comic Relief when we were younger was part of what sparked my interest in comedy, because I saw it as this opportunity for political change.
Interesting.
And it was like, oh, all of these people are funny. They're at the top of their game. And there's not been a specific disaster, right? Because, you know, we can do USA for America live. We can do things that are responding to natural disasters. This is a perpetual problem. And they're like, let's do something.
You ever see that 30 Rock where they created a benefit for whatever was going to happen? Like, Alec Baldwin just had them, and then Jake
Krakowski, just be ready.
It was like, we feel so bad for those people that were subjected to that thing.
Nice. But that's what it's turned into.
Yeah, well, it's become a genre. Right. It's become a formula. It's like somebody's talking about Behind the Music, how odd it was that everybody's life story had the same exact beats. Where they, you know, they got everything, then they lost everything, then they got it back. It's like, how did all these people in these different eras have the same life?
Right.
And it reminds me of an argument. This is one of the deepest podcasts we've ever done. I'm afraid we've alienated people who are like, sorry. I want to know more about Daredevil.
Sorry, we can talk more. Tell me, we can talk about why I should be watching Daredevil.
No, I get a question that's going to turn around. But I remember arguing with my dad about Joseph Campbell, who wrote Man with a Thousand Faces and The Hero's Journey. And he said, I don't like Joseph Campbell. And I said, why? I thought it was brilliant the way he broke everything, where he broke down King Arthur and all these mythologies into the basic beats of like, this is how people get an aspirational story. He said, because he did the same thing to Jesus, and Jesus happened. And so Joseph Campbell is atheist.
Got it.
And then when I thought about it, I realized, well, it's just like Behind the Music. You know what? Leif Garrett did all those things.
Right.
And so did MC Hammer.
Exactly.
Like, MC Hammer's not a made-up person, as much as I want him to be.
Don't hurt the hammer.
But there is a way to tell a story.
Right.
I mean, you look at biopics. You look at, you all know, Walk the Line and Ray were the same goddamn movie.
Mm-hmm.
But they both were real events.
Right. And they draw us in. And that's what I mean. It's like, what's the form? Once you know the formula, if you're going to use it, how do you use it so that it's not as predictable, or that it offers some hope? But you get into, it's so easy to get into that rut. It's so easy to get into that,
you know,
that, and I find it with jokes. You know, you see people where even now when people, I teach a social justice comedy class, and I one of the things I've learned, it's like you hit people quick with those short, funny jokes, you get your audience, and then you go into a little bit longer, a little bit more, you know. And sometimes my students will start with a story, and I'm like, you're 45 seconds into a story that doesn't have a punchline for another 30.
Yeah.
That's not going to work.
That's how I started, too, because I was always into guys like Carlin and Cosby, God rest his reputation.
Yeah, exactly.
who were storytellers. And my first joke was a minute and a half.
Yeah.
And then, and that's when I learned it's like, you have to earn their trust.
Exactly.
And they have to know who you are. And that's why that opening joke is so critical.
Yep.
Which was the mistake I made in Philly, was that, you know, was my opening joke was dry and observational and full of pop culture references.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't hard hitting.
Yeah.
And I had a hard time writing hard hitting stuff because I was always, if you listen to me on the show, I'm always kind of dry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I loved guys like Cleese and Bob Newhart.
Got it.
You know, guys who were like a little reserved. I've never been the like, how you doing? Hey, hey, hey.
Yeah.
You know, in high school, I was more Robin Williams.
I was going to say, I was like, this is interesting. I was like, I could see you turning into, but like my experience of you is so high energy.
Yeah. And I'm on coffee now, so.
Right. Yeah. No, I got it. Because when we were talking about the name of the podcast, or when I was thinking about the name of the podcast, I was like, he doesn't need any caffeine. But, I'm thinking of like 17, 18-year-old.
Yeah,
yeah.
God, if I was on coffee at 17. Oh, no.
I remember
I was in my 20s. So I was at the bar and we were talking about drugs. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, I said I had no interest in ever doing cocaine. Mm-hmm. And the person I was with went, good. I said, yeah, because it's a terrible drug and it's addictive and everybody I've seen on cocaine turns into asshole. Goes, no. He goes, no, Clark, because if you were on cocaine, we'd strangle you.
Yeah, no, that's real talk. That's real talk.
Yeah.
I could see
like
that.
Like, it's mellowed. I was with a friend of mine whose kids are friends with my kids, and we're like standing there and watching these kids just run around crazy. And it's that kind of like freeform, just running.
Yeah.
And he turns to me, he goes, wow, we used to have that energy. Where did it go? And I said, we gave it to them. Because now it takes all my energy to go, climb down on that fence.
Every time I like watch my friends, because I love to play. So I'm always like, let me babysit. I want to play. I am exhausted because it's not all fun. It's not all play.
Well, they have the energy reserved. You don't anymore. It just reminds you of it reminds you that you're getting old.
Right.
You know, I'm getting to the point now where I walked to the downtown area last night, and I'm like, this seems far.
Nice.
The greatest thing in the world.
This week.
All right, this has been a very serious discussion this week, which I think is great. But what, Misha, what you told me does not explain why you like 80s pop so much.
Because it's God's gift to the world. I mean, I think it's pretty odd. Have you listened to, like, I mean, there's 80s pop music and then there's the rest of what's happening.
Yeah, that's what 80s pop music is. It's related to nothing that's happening.
Here's the thing. Because
right here, right now, and I think that's 91, is the closest thing you get to a protest song.
Yeah, no, but the thing, it's 80s pop music in terms of, like, the actual songs. First of all, the power ballads alone. Like, if you don't feel something at the end of, I don't care if you're talking like
Love Bleeds.
Yeah, like you could be talking like Def Leppard, Whitney Houston. It doesn't matter. Like when they go in and you feel it and you're there. You're there. Or you have no soul. You're either there or you have no soul. Those are your two options. And then I can't help you.
I have a friend of mine who goes to this message board. I forget what it is. But they said they've defined the term city rock. And what city rock is it has to be, it's definitely 80s, but it has to be about the city.
Mm-hmm.
Usually about the night and the city.
Uh-huh.
And there has to be a saxophone in it.
Yes.
We were watching The Lost Boys again.
Oh, wow.
Because we were in Santa Cruz.
Okay.
Last time I was in California. Mm-hmm. And my brother-in-law was like, you know, Lost Boys took place here. So then was on Amazon Prime. We had to watch it. And there was the most 80s man ever. The scene where they go to the beach party, mm-hmm. where like Jason Patrick meets Jamie Gertz, who had a better career than Jason Patrick.
I know. Who does not get?
I don't know. But the band that's playing, if you remember, the lead singer is hugely muscle bound, mm-hmm. oiled, in leather pants,
yes.
with a ponytail, and holding a saxophone.
Yes.
All at once. That's the most 80s man who ever lived.
Yes. Well, because that's the thing with the 80s pop is like it bridges contradictions and helps you find that common ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you feel something.
Makes you feel good, usually.
Yeah. I mean, there's, first of all, you think about the songs that you're going to sing along to. There's like solid choruses. Don mm-hmm. Henley, Boys of Summer.
Yeah.
Howard Jones, No One's Ever to Blame. Like, you also have like the whole new wave was coming out, alternative stuff.
Stepping out,
like you've got the poppy pop, but mm-hmm. you also have the, like the alternative pop. You have hip hop on the rise.
That's true.
As like
80s hip hop is pretty awesome.
I mean, that's the thing, because we just started to listen to everything, and you know, growing up in New York, we had Z100 back then.
Yep.
Played everything,
and that's what we were talking about losing the mainstream. Was we all listened to Top 40?
We all listened to everything, so you got a taste. And then as you grew older, you could decide, hey, I want to go in on this.
Right.
And I'm just going to listen to like New Order and Erasure and Depeche Mode and The Cure and do that.
And I think it did kind of, I think it did kind of open your mind. I remember coming back from, I think you might have been in our van. We were coming back from a forensic meet.
Uh-huh.
And I think we took a couple other schools with us. So I think you were in the van. You can tell me if you weren't. And everybody was kind of playing, you know, we all had cassette tapes, and
right.
somebody always had a boombox on their legs.
Nice.
Because nobody had a good cassette player in right. a car. And I remember we were all playing something, and Joe Schweinzer, who was on my team, put in Metallica's Injustice for All.
Nice.
And played Blackened. And I remember everyone in that fan, I'd never heard it. And uh-huh. I was saying I didn't like heavy metal.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody in it was like, that was amazing.
Well, you pushed me to that rock metal edge that mm-hmm. I didn't really know before, like except for the stuff that was on. And I remembered, we were talking about this earlier, you made me this cassette tape that was mostly a throwback. It wasn't 80s, but it helped me understand.
I like old things. So in the 80s, it would have been all 60s.
It was all 60s.
Yeah.
But it laid the foundation, because everyone had told me about Jimi Hendrix, but you were the first person to play Jimi Hendrix for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I could actually understand and see the trajectory when I picked up and became Living Color's greatest fan, and I still love them today.
We both of us were obsessed with Living Color.
Now, do you understand that I see them every year?
Really?
So last year I saw them on both coasts. That was my birthday present to
myself. I saw them open for the Rolling Stones. It was my first concert ever, 1989.
Yep, Shea Stadium.
Yep, Shea Stadium. I had that, and I had their second album, which I really, really liked.
Yeah, time's up. So
yeah,
So I've followed their career. I haven't stopped listening to them. They took a break for a while. They came back to the point now where when I go to the concerts, Corey's like, okay, just okay. Because he knows I want pictures. I want things. They should never sign anything else for me ever again. They've signed everything.
So but, you're a super living color nerd.
Oh, huge, huge. I love them. I love them. So they're working on their new album. They're in the studio. It was supposed to come out last year. But you know how these things go. So they're back in this. They were on tour, so they toured the 25th anniversary.
Are all four original members still there?
So Muzz left after the first album. Muzz Skillings left, and Doug,
yeah, he wasn't on Time's Up.
Yeah, so Doug Wimbush came and he's been with the band since. So wow. Everybody else is there. Vernon even like hurt his fingers and still figured out how to like play through the tour last year. So they did a tour of the 25th anniversary of Vivid, and they played the entire album, which is awesome, plus some new stuff that's coming out on the latest album. And they're a prime example of Cult of Personality and Open Letter to a Landlord.
Yep.
Like, they're talking politics. Like, you can burn a building right. down, but, you know, you can't erase a memory. That's all about gentrification. That's all about the same stuff. It was 25 years ago.
Yep.
And that music still stands. And the quality of the songs, not just the lyrics, but the quality of the actual music also stands. So, man, don't get me started. Let me go. That's a whole other. I might need 2.5 podcasts for that. Just I had that, every decade.
I had that on vinyl and CD.
Nice.
When I transitioned from vinyl to CD, I don't think I have it anymore.
Oh, that's okay. I'll replace it.
All right.
I got you.
I don't think it made it to MP3.
It may not have, but I will tell you, they're still doing their thing, and minus the spandex.
The
spandex has been replaced by Argyle sweaters and ties and vests, you know.
The word of a Malcolm X.
Exactly. They're looking a little different these days, but you know, still rocking it out. And it's funny to go to these concerts. I was like thinking when we were little, like the oldie shows that our parents used to go, like the doo-wop, I'm like, what does that look like for us? And is this me right now? Because I'm here with a bunch of other Gen Xers, and we are getting our life. Like when they play Cult of Personality and everybody's like bugging out and it's awesome. It's like, yeah, we're all going to have knee challenges in the morning. We're all going to feel this. You know, I've been in 2 mosh pits and shows, and they all lasted less than the song.
Mike Lazzari, one of the Lazzari twins. Who we knew in high school, took me to a Henry Rollins show.
Oh, wow.
And we ran away from the mosh pit.
Well, I was going to say, well, what was it, college or was it like?
College, yeah. So it's 94, it's around the, I'm forgetting the albums, but it's after Little Self-Opinion, it's around Liar.
So I saw him, I want to say it was junior year maybe, senior year of college, it was like that same thing, that 94 and that.
Yeah.
There was no steel toe that could. I couldn't. I was like, why? I wanted to watch the mosh pit from like an observation room. Yeah, that was intense.
We were throwing girls behind us to get out of there because before he started, he said to me, he's like, you know, the mosh pit's going to probably, we should probably move towards the back. And I'm like, mosh pit's in the front, man. We're in the middle of the room. And this was, Bottom Line. Village Gate down there. Was
you were in New York?
In New York.
Oh, yeah. You're playing games. You should have been way in the back. What?
I know. Well, when it started, shows. The whole thing just erupted. And we were like, let's get at it. Steel Toed Dark Martins. That was, I think about that show often because Therapy opened.
Oh.
And wow. I got really into them because they were like an Irish Nirvana, but metal. Yep. Uh-huh. And they were my favorite band for years. I just keep bringing up their songs in my cover band to play. Nice. And then I always remember the crowd work he did was he brought this jazz trumpet player on stage, and he's like, we're gonna try a new song, and somebody in the crowd goes, this song sucks, and he goes, well then now's your chance to fuck off and let the rest of us enjoy it, and I was like, he shut him down so fast.
That was a huge
night. I can't do a show like that anymore. Well, it's like when I go to a U2 show, I realize that we're all getting old.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Well, but they're, I mean, talk about standing the test of time. Yeah. You know, like.
I mean, people make fun of them a lot now. We did a whole show about, like, the whole Apple debacle.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a decent album.
I mean, they're saying something. They're doing what's true to them.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like, do what's true to you. Find your audience. Find your people. And like, just be excellent.
And that
just be excellent.
That actually leads me into my thing because I just finished a biography on Elvis Costello.
Oh, nice.
Called The Man in His Music. I'm a huge Elvis Costello fan. Mm-hmm. I like just covered him in college. Never let go. I've seen him like three times.
Nice.
And his story was so interesting because he's not a guy that gives a lot of interviews. Mm-hmm. So I didn't. I found it in Half Price Books. It was a secondhand bookshop. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that might be interesting to read. And then I realized, I don't know anything about this guy. I've been in this guy for 20 years. I don't know it. I don't know what his story is. Like, I can tell you the Beatles story, like, at Spider-Man's origin.
Yes.
You know, because it's so iconic. I'm like, I don't know why Elvis Costello did these records, and I don't know what happened. And the story was so interesting was that he was a guy who was a songwriter that was just driven, and he was in a band that wasn't that good, so he broke them up.
Mm-hmm.
And he was writing these songs, and when he got signed, they put him into punk, and they pushed him. They changed his name to Elvis Costello because everybody changed their name in punk. Nice. And they told him to be, like, nasty to the journalists. And he did it to an extent where the journalists turned against him.
Oh, wow.
And they went from loving him. His first two albums, he was the darling. It was like Talking Heads. Mm-hmm. Like, or Lou Reed, just every album's like, right. this is incredible. And he was such a jerk to them mm-hmm. in interviews for his punk image that they were just like, we're done with you. And then his sales started going down. And this was still in the days where you didn't get dropped from your record label.
Oh.
So he, I think he freaked out from the fame a little bit.
Mm.
And he kind of torpedoed his own career. But he hit this nice sweet spot where today you'd just be gone.
Right.
But he was so talented and he was so popular from the first couple albums that he just settled into this mid-level.
Mm.
And then he spent the rest of his career just doing whatever he wanted. He's like, this next record's going to be a country record. This next record's going to be a jazz record. This next record, I'm breaking up the band and bringing in Burt Bacharach.
Wow.
And, you know, he's...
Burt Bacharach.
Oh, he did a whole album with Burt Bacharach.
What?
It was like one of... In the 90s, it was one of his bigger hits.
Wow.
Yeah, he did a string quartet record.
I remember that.
Yeah, in the 90s. He wrote songs with Paul McCartney. He's like...
Nice.
He's had this career that's gone everywhere, and the book was saying that he was being geared to be the next Springsteen.
Ah.
And because he shook that tree a little too hard, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. he's never been that popular. He's always been kind of a B guy, you know, kind of a cult guy. So in my college years, he was the guy I could hang on to mm-hmm. of like, oh, yeah, you're rolling a Bob Dylan, but that's because you haven't heard enough Elvis Costello records.
Right.
In the same way that I was like, you're into Woody Allen because you haven't seen all of Albert Brooks's films.
Right, you know? Right. You can
be indie, but not too indie.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
But he managed to hit the sweet spot where he gets to do whatever he wants. He's got a core audience that follows him, and I'm one of those people. I have every one of his records.
Nice.
But it's interesting, like Living Color. It's interesting mm-hmm. where if you hit it high enough,
mm-hmm.
you can exist.
Right.
You know, you don't have to be a computer programmer.
Right.
Like, you know, talking right. about the one hit you had.
Right. But you also have to be consistent, and you have to be true. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, they can't make the music that they're not trying to make the music they made when they were 25.
Right.
Because it's not, you know, that's not who they are now. So you talk about what's happening for you from where you are.
Yeah. And you see bands that do that. Mm-hmm. And it's like the Rolling Stones are going out on tour again. They're not recording an album because the last few albums, it was like they were trying to record their 70s albums and the mm-hmm. songs weren't that great. And eventually they were like, well, then who cares?
Right.
Like, people are going to come out and see us. So why are we writing these songs that are trying to sound like mm-hmm. a different era?
And people want to hear that old stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's what you know, that's what you love. And it doesn't mean that you don't keep creating. Artists right. should always keep creating as they feel called to, but don't get so caught up in the business that you're creating just because you feel like you have to.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Well, Misha, thank you for coming over.
Man, thank you. This has been awesome.
This was so much fun.
Okay, can we not wait 25 years for the next time, though?
No, that, we that have to be... wait 25 years because okay. we're out of material now.
All right. Oh, well.
You know what? It's like the Adam West Batman. You have to let it go a couple of decades until everyone misses it.
And then you bring it back.
Yes.
Okay.
But, Misha, where are you performing next?
Next, I will be back in California, in the Bay Area in June, likely in Mill Valley. Still signing contracts, so I won't say too much about that.
Well, how can we follow you online?
MishaMosley.com. You can find everything you need to know there. Pretty simple. You know, I'm not super creative. Just my name.
And Twitter?
Twitter, Misha Mosley. Facebook, Misha Mosley. Oh, yeah.
and there's a C. And Misha.
M-I-C-I-A.
Yeah, I thought your name was M-I-S-H-A for like 3 years.
Yeah, it's, you know, it happens.
But those, that was back in the day when you wrote somebody's phone number into a book.
Exactly.
And you wrote it however you wanted to write it.
And that was it, as long as the numbers were right. They pick up the phone.
I feel like 60% of this conversation is how old Generation X is.
That's okay, because, you know, another thing I'll say is look out for X Marks the Spot. It's the play I'm working on that's all about Generation X. And people will understand. We are the greatest generation. We are the greatest generation.
Well, you can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. You can like the Facebook page. That's where we put most of our breaking news, because I forget to put it on Twitter.
Nice.
You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher and I believe Blueberry. Or if you hate all of those things like Bill Monroe hates every Apple product, nice. You can just go to caffeinatedcomics.blogspot.com. And Steven, who's not here today, owns Chimera's Comics, and that is on 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. We'll talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Thanks!